This is Edward Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our program today was a panel discussion on President Donald Trump's first 100 days in office. Our panel included Monica Davey, the Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, John McCormick, who's a political reporter for the Bloomberg News, Kristen McQuarrie, who's a member of the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune, and Dick Longworth, a distinguished fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, who has reported from 80 countries on 5 different continents. The panelists all began by saying that they felt that President Trump was not curious intellectually, and he was rather physically lazy. Walking from the golf cart to the golf course was about the only exercise he appears to be getting. Over 100 days, the panel agreed that he had performed better than many had expected him to. I thought this was interesting because the panel, with the exception of one of the panelists, might be described as being a little left of center. He was knocked by all four for his tweeting. They agreed that it's a good way to reach his base, but he's going to have to go much further if possible. They all faulted him on his approach to foreign affairs. They said that the people who are involved in foreign affairs in his office are inexperienced, and there are many key appointments left to be filled. Today, the House of Representatives voted on the American Health Care Act. The panelists, we didn't know how the vote went at the time. However, they said that if it passed, which it did, Trump will get the credit because he went out and worked in twisted arms. If it didn't pass, Congress would carry the X on their backs. In the area of foreign affairs, they talked about whether or not NATO was obsolete, how do we relate to a dictator, and as Dick Longworth said, the lion frequently may lie down with the lamb, but that lamb will be very nervous.
Monica, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Is this turned on?
It's on.
It's on. Okay. Thank you so much for having me here. It's really nice to be here. I have been here during my City News Bureau days covering your afternoon newsmakers, so it's a nice return home. That was a long time ago. So for what it's worth, though, I should say that when I was invited to come speak about Trump's first 100 days, I said I was not the right person to invite to this event. These folks actually cover the Trump administration, and we've got fantastic New York Times correspondents like Peter Baker and Maggie Haberman and a list of many wonderful correspondents who cover the White House every day from Washington. And that's not what I do. But what I do is I cover 11 states in the Midwest. From Chicago, but I cover 11 states surrounding us, and these are some of the very states that had a really important role in putting President Trump into office. If you ask me, what we're seeing out here in the Midwest is every bit as fascinating as what they're seeing in Washington. So let me share just a couple quick snippets, and I know we only have 3 minutes, I'm going to stick to that. A couple quick snippets from my last 100 days that I've been thinking about some. One was a trip to southern Illinois to a coal county that had voted overwhelmingly for President Trump, but found itself wrestling with questions about the immigration policies of this administration. One of this little town's own favored sons, a guy whose name was Juan Carlos Hernandez Pacheco, was detained because it turned out he didn't have the proper papers. He's illegal. But the people in this town objected, and the mayor did, the prosecutor did, the fire chief did, because this guy had been such a big contributor and helper to this community for so many years, and they didn't understand that he was illegal until he was detained. So that was one snippet that I came away thinking about, what are we seeing here? Another snippet, and I think some of you will probably recognize this story, but a colleague of mine, Julie Bosman, who also works in the Chicago Bureau of the New York Times, worked on a story about a mayor's race in Bolingbrook, Illinois, where the mayor's, the very longtime mayor, having a run for reelection, should have been an easy ride, but his relationship with Donald Trump and his help for Donald Trump last fall ended up making it a really close race. He won. Roger Clare won reelection, but it was really narrow, victory. And then right here in Chicago, one more snippet of things I'm thinking about in the last 100 days. We wrote about President Trump's relationship and interest with the city of Chicago, and his tweets about the violence here, his thoughts about his comments about Chicago. And the story left us wondering what this may or may not mean for federal involvement in what's happening here, what the DOJ will or won't do, and what happens this summer with the violence and how that plays out here. So I guess for the moment, I think it's way too early to say what any of this adds up to, if anything. But it feels to me like watching things play out in the Midwest, it all is coming through that lens now. And maybe that's not surprising. Maybe you see that with every administration. But I am surprised at how often now any story unrelated to politics in Washington is really coming through that lens. I was working on a story in Indiana not too long ago, and it was nothing to do with federal policy or politics. It was a story about housing policy in a small town. And the guy told me, he confided after we were done with the interview, he said off the record that he wanted to tell me that he was a longtime Democrat, a union guy, and he had voted for Donald Trump. And did I know whether he was going to change the healthcare policy? And did I know whether he could actually change taxes for rich people? Is that really going to happen? And I guess I came away understanding only that, like, this is what's being asked out there. People are sorting this out in a more intense way than I have seen before, than I saw in previous administrations. People are looking at this and trying to figure it out all over the Midwest. So,
well, thank you, Monica.
I blew that deadline. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're good. John?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's humbling to be here with really what are some of the best journalists in this town. So it's just humbling to be here with them. I, like Monica, have covered a lot of these events, usually from the back of the room where I actually prefer to be. But thanks for having me up here today. In terms of, you know, Donald Trump's first 100 days, I think I'm going to tell my little snippet here through basically two marriages that Donald Trump has. And he's a guy who's had three marriages, so he should be able to manage these two. But it's I'm sort of a data guy, and so I'm gonna walk just through a few key polling numbers that are out there that sort of, you know, put his first 100 days in some perspective. Heavy lunch. I'll try not to bore you too much with these. But, you know, most of us have heard that Trump's approval rating now is historically low for somebody at this point in the presidency. It's around 40%. And that now ranks as the least popular president among the last 12 White House occupants at this point in a first term. But it's all relative. Gallup, which polls on a daily basis, looked at approval rating by geography. And in big cities like Chicago, his approval rating is even lower, 28%. In working class country, though, they call this area working class country, which is mostly Appalachia coal areas, and probably parts of southern Illinois would fit in as well. His approval rating's at 64%. Aging farmlands, he's at 64%. Evangelical hubs, which they consider to be mostly the rural South, he's at 63%. So as this polling suggests, Trump has a strong base of support, at least in certain parts of the country.
Alderman, turn off your phone.
And among certain demographic groups as well, 96% of his voters say they would vote for him again. But there is some evidence that they may not have unlimited patience with him. And it doesn't mean that, you know, even among his base, it doesn't mean that everybody is happy with everything that he's doing. His ratings for honesty have fallen considerably, even among his base, people who, you know, when they ask whether do you think he's an honest person or not. About 6 weeks ago, I was in southern Wisconsin, not too far from here, in Paul Ryan's district, working on a story about the potential repeal of Obamacare and some tax provisions that were part of that first bill, and I think will probably be part of this bill this afternoon. And I talked to a guy in the Hiawatha Bar and Grill in Sturtevant, Wisconsin, on a Saturday afternoon. He was with a group, and he was definitely on his second pitcher of beer, but still very with it. And I asked him about Trump and you know this healthcare situation, and what he said and this fits with my marriage theme. He said, "It pisses me off, but my wife pisses me off too, and we're still married." So I think that sort of encapsulates some Trump voters. They are going to stick with him. Now, the second part of the marriage, his relationship with Congress. And I think that marriage is probably even more important right now than his marriage with the voters. He doesn't really have to face the voters other than in polls for another, about 1,300 days or so. Presidency is right around 1,400 days. So that second marriage is a little rocky as well. I think we'll have a much better report on how that marriage is going later this afternoon once we see this vote on the health care bill. That really could be a helpful thing for him if they are able to get that through. But prior to the health care vote, there were real signs that the Republicans in Congress are ignoring his wishes. Bloomberg carried a headline earlier this week that said, "Congress inks spending deal that jettisons Trump priorities." That was Monday morning. And so in the spending bill that was passed, there's no money for building the wall. The EPA, which Trump has sought to shrink dramatically, would receive a 1% reduction in funding and no staff cuts. So that the EPA office here in Chicago is presumably safe for at least a while. Just half of the increase Trump wanted for the Pentagon. He didn't manage to defund Planned Parenthood. Overall, non-defense domestic spending will go up as he wanted. But presidential clout is a very tenuous thing, and Trump really does need some wins here pretty soon. Congress is going to adjourn for the summer before we know it. It's already May. And if he is not able to put some points on the board fairly soon, he really will find that he's gone through his first year here without any major legislative accomplishments. But again, to be seen this afternoon.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Kristen, you're up at bat.
Okay. Monica reminded me before I sat down that they're on the news side. I'm on the opinion side. So she's counting on me to offer my opinion. So here it comes, like it or not. Debate about the significance of the first 100 days is some scholars say it's an immeasurable and kind of silly number that the media uses. Others say it's pivotal in setting the tone for the presidency. I would say for Donald Trump, he probably fits into that latter category because, like it or not, he has shown a refusal to back down on certain issues, including the wall, even though, as John points out, it's not included in the budget. He is continuing to feed his base by pushing back against the media, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Policy-wise, he has been consistent as a candidate. I would say just in general, his first 100 days are inartful at best and incompetent at worst. John talked about poll numbers. 40% is, in fact, the lowest number as long as polls have been reliable. But I would suggest that given the amount of scrutiny that he has received, I'm actually surprised it's at 40%. This is just a really cursory Google search. I would not put this in the newspaper, but it's City Club, so what the heck. If you just Google, Obama's first 100 days from January 2009 to April of 2009, and you limit it to those words, you pop up like 22,000 news stories. You do the same search on Donald Trump. So it's 22,000 for Obama. It's 868,000 for Trump. So again, based on that, it's kind of remarkable. He's at 40%. I think we're probably going to get to foreign policy issues through the discussion, so I'll skip that for now. But I think his U.S. Supreme Court pick will probably be memorialized as one of his accomplishments during the first 100 days. It was a torturous hearing process if you watched it or listened to it. I did. But getting Gorsuch eventually added to the bench, even with the Senate pulling the nuclear option, will probably be one of his accomplishments looking back. And his cabinet picks, as controversial as they are, if someone like Betsy DeVos can, in fact, downsize the Department of Education and expand school choice, which are issues that Trump ran on, she will be considered another of his accomplishments during the first 100 days. Again, the non-traditional cabinet received much more press and coverage than previous administrations from Rex Tillerson, Ben Carson, Rick Perry. But so far, I don't see anyone causing dramatic upheaval with the administration. We'll see. I even like Mick Mulvaney, his budget director, which everyone seems to hate. Obamacare is today. I don't know that, I mean, if it goes down, it will be, I think, more of a mark on Congress than it will on the president, even though he's gotten more involved in this version. I think whatever happens again will be more of a target on the back of congressional Republicans. Almost the same for tax reform. Even Obama in his first 100 days could not get a Democratic Congress to go along with some of his tax ideas, which also included going after wealthy earners. Yes, the Democratic Congress blocked that too. Its tax reform is very hard to pass, regardless of which party is in charge. You could ask David Camp, who tried to roll out tax reform in 2014 and was basically scorned by his own party because how dare he, in an election year, make them take a difficult vote or issue. John talked a lot about the budget. I think the biggest issue there was that we're not going to see a government shutdown, so I guess if the president considers that a win, it could be considered a win. But unfortunately, the same consistency of candidate has dogged Trump as president. His lack of circumspection, the gaps in his basic policy knowledge, his obsession with evaluating issues based on wins and polls and ratings, his tweets, and generally his penchant for making the jobs harder for everyone around him, for his cabinet members, for his communications team. Their job is to defend him no matter what, and he makes that extremely difficult, which could spell serious trouble ahead for the administration. And we haven't even talked about Paul Manafort, Carter Page, talk of impeachment. Certainly that is still an issue in his first 100 days. But, I mean, I would say for all of the hysteria when he was elected, so far he has stuck to the issues he's campaigned on. He has a few wins. His first 100 days have not been as bad as United Airlines last 100 days, but probably not as good of results as his base had hoped.
Thank you. Thank you, Kristen. And Dick Longworth.
I'm another City News grad. I never got to cover the City Club. They gave me the morgue. Things have improved since my day. I'm supposed to talk about foreign policy, I think, the entire globe in about 3 minutes, so I'll try to talk fast. The lead is that American leadership since under the Trump administration, I think, has been badly damaged. Certainly our position in the world has been called into question for a lot of the personal instability that Kristen talked about. Now, what do I mean about that? For the past 75 years, ever since World War II, the United States has presided over what is probably one of the longest periods of peace and general prosperity, certainly in our Western part of the world, and increasingly that spreading over to China, India, and other countries, that's ever been known. We did this through strong leadership, leading through institutions, leading with a vision of where we wanted to go. We still are in a position to carry that out. We are still by far the strongest nation in the world, no matter what anybody says. We have the biggest economy, certainly the strongest military. We are the leader of the world. We're the nation everybody else looks to. And so far, there is no successor in sight to provide this sort of stability and leadership. So the world really does look to us to carry this out as an important role, and they're looking at this country now and wondering what in the world literally is going on. Trump's first 100 days, the lead, has shaken this sense of stability and leadership in two different areas. First, I think, would say the instruments of leadership. Rex Tillerson seems to be a substantial character, but he's a rookie in a very important job, and he certainly does not have the team in place to help him and shows no interest in filling those jobs. We have too many vacant positions, not only in the State Department, but in the other agencies that deal with the world. Secondly, there is an overemphasis so far on excuse me, on the military. People like Mattis and McMasters are substantial characters. They are more on the military side of things, whereas soft power seems to be taking the back seat. By soft power, I mean the use of diplomacy through the State Department, aid through USAID, certainly the cultural side of it. The emphasis on education and culture is a very important part of our foreign policy. It's what makes us attractive to the rest of the world. It makes other people want to be on our side. You don't see an awful lot of boat people fighting to get into China. We are an attractive country, and that is a real plus in foreign policy, but it's part of the soft power, which the Trump budget, if carried through, would undermine. The second part, apart from the instruments of leadership, I think is the exercise of leadership. The world does look to us to be steady, to be responsible, mostly to be predictable. They don't like surprises from here. You know, as they say, the lion may lie down with the lamb, but the lamb won't get much sleep. A lot of the world over the years lies awake at night wondering what this big, powerful, good-natured, good-hearted, but sometimes clumsy country can do. When we fall off the wagon, we fall off with a bang, as in places like Vietnam and Iraq. But basically, we have been predictable. The world can look to us, know if there's a crisis, know that we will carry this through in a predictable and a steady way. And now, who knows? You know, what do we stand? What is our policy? Is Putin our pal or not? Is China a currency manipulator or not? Is NATO obsolete or not? Do we like democracies like Australia or Canada? Or are we pals with dictators like Kim or Duterte? Nobody knows on this. There is this uncertainty about what we are going to do, what our values are, where our policy is going to go. And this is scary. I don't know. Nobody knows. There's a general feeling that Trump doesn't know. So far, as several of the other speakers have said, we've made it through the first 100 days. Okay, so far, so good. But we really haven't had a foreign policy crisis yet. It's going to come. It always does come. And when it comes, nobody knows how this administration, this president will react. And that's scary.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much. And thank all of our panelists. So, we're now open to questions. So, if you have a question, just hold your hand up. Amanda from our staff, our social media maven, is coming around to collect those questions. The very first question is from Richard Smiley. Richard, where are you? Oh, right there. Okay. Not a member of the City Club. On the way out, you'll be moved off to a side and we'll fleece you of $35. He's with NCSBN. Will Trump last all 4 years in office? Who would like to start that?
Well,
John McCormick, you look eager.
He's a 70-year-old man, probably. And I think, you know, talk of impeachment, while it percolates once in a while on the far left of the political aisle, I suspect Donald Trump will be in office at least 460 days. Prediction, but who knows?
If I may say, Evan Osnos, one of our former colleagues at the Tribune, has an excellent article in the current New Yorker on just that subject. And he goes into it in some depth, how you get rid of a president, how you could get rid of this president. Basically, it's very instructive in how you do it, but he points out really just how hard it is. And people already are questioning his mental stability. As Evan says, this is not a medical issue. It's a political issue, and politics decides.
Kristen and Monica, any
thoughts?
No,
I read Evan's article, and I think he points out fairly that given the Republican control of the House and Senate, at least for this term, they would have to get behind any sort of impeachment effort, and that seems highly unlikely.
Thank you. Monica?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. That doesn't mean that you don't hear on the left people imagining and dreaming of how he might be out of here any second, and imagining that the Russian stuff is going to somehow eventually mean something. And And then you have people on the right who talk about what he's going to do in his second term. So I think, you know, how do we know? I think people are inside their little worlds. You know, we're a little bit stuck in our separate worlds, and maybe we should all read Evan's story and accept the fact that this is probably at least one term.
Okay. This is from City Club member Warren Ribley, who's sitting down here. How has President Trump's tweeting impacted or changed how you report on the news of prominent issues other than causing you to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning? Who wants to go with it?
I'll go with that. I think this doesn't impact me as much, anywhere near as much as it impacts the White House correspondents. But I think it is interesting to see how media organizations are trying to handle this. Do you write everything that he tweets? Do you let him tweet it and see how do we decide this? I mean, what is this? This is sort of a new way of announcing policy, sort of. And I think it's a really hard thing to navigate. There have been several tweets about Chicago in the middle of the night, and so that impacts me. And trying to make a decision of does this rise to news? And it's hard. I guess the thing about it as a reporter, not as a citizen, but as a reporter, the hard piece of it is 140 characters. You can't get enough information. You can't ask follow-up questions to that. You can't figure out if there's something ambiguous about it. It's really hard to dissect that. And so I think this is something all media organizations are wrestling with how to handle.
At Bloomberg, this has actually been a really big deal because the president does move markets, and we care about markets a lot. And especially early on, he was moving company stocks with his tweets. And so we have a whole computer team that has gotten around this, and I get email alerts the second he tweets something. So they often are some of the first emails I see when I wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning. But like Monica said, they can be very, it takes a little bit of deciphering to figure out what they really mean. And as they've been so frequent, and as time has gone by, we've seen that the market doesn't react as much as it used to. Stocks might briefly move, but they tend to bounce back pretty quick, sometimes after 20 minutes even. And so sometimes making too much noise will mean that people don't listen to you quite as much as they used to.
I just find it astonishing that he still tweets, that no one has been able to get him to abandon that because it's so self-destructive. But to John's point, I think one of his first few tweets as president was targeting Boeing. And we deal with this in the editorial board. We're deciding what to write about. You know, oh my gosh, he's going after specific corporations. This is crazy. But then in a weird way, his tweets are either completely false or they're kind of in the ballpark. So you sort of know where he's coming from. And when it came to the Boeing tweet, he was actually, I think, talking about the larger problem with the F-35 and corporate welfare and how he's going to change all this. But it's just, it is continually surprising. I'd love for someone to explain to me how they've been unable, even with the CIA and all of the protections that and all of the qualifiers that a president has to adhere to, that he is still allowed to have a Twitter account.
Dick?
One advantage being out of the news business is that I don't have to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning to check on presidential tweets. But if this confuses us, can you imagine how this looks to other leaders? That when he tweets his latest thought on some far-flung part of the world, how do they explain this? How do they understand it? What do other countries think we mean by this? This is not in the normal course of events for American presidents or for leaders anywhere. And so you've got a lot of American diplomats, the ones who are still in the State Department, earning their pay, going around trying to calm the rest of the world down about the wee hour tweet.
Okay, thank you. This is from Peter Scozzi, who's with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. Your thoughts on the future of domestic energy, coal, wind, solar, etc. And he wonders, he's stuck in a twofer. Have news organizations changed the way they cover politics? He listens to NPR, and he says he's noticed a change.
Wait, these are big questions.
It's a big organization.
Yeah, okay. Where is Peter? Here's Peter. Did you go to lab school?
I did.
Me too. Okay. I recognize your name.
Don't hold it
again. I'm a fellow alum. So can you help me understand, what do you mean about media change? I can't answer your energy question. I have no idea. But your media question.
Was somewhat shocked by the results of the election. Maybe they were missing something in the public. And it seems as if now, at least when I listen to NPR, they're digging a little deeper, trying to talk to sources they had not in the past spoken with.
Yeah, I think, obviously there was a ton of coverage before the election that said that the result was going to be the opposite way, that all signs were it was not going to come out the way it did. I think that has necessarily and rightly forced some reexamination of, how did the media get it wrong? And I think that, I think everybody is doing a little soul searching about that, the organizations in a big way, but individuals. And I think if there's a lesson for me personally, it's that you got to talk to more people. It's really simple. It's not really about statistics. It's not about polls. It's not about we need to keep talking to the people in Michigan, keep talking to the people in Wisconsin, keep talking to the people in Ohio, find out what they're really thinking about, and don't make assumptions about what that is. But I think that's all healthy.
Anyone else on our panel want to talk to
just real
to
quick,
that?
I mean, to buttress Monica's sort of opening statement, she and I work for news organizations that are largely based in Washington and New York, and they can sometimes think of even a place like Chicago as flyover country. So while maybe some folks in the Rust Belt aren't real happy about a Donald Trump presidency, it has meant that all of a sudden we're a little bit more on the map for those news organizations, that we are going to have to pay more attention to some of these Midwestern states. So that's a good thing from a selfish perspective.
Okay. Graham Grady, who's with Taft Law, City Club member. Kristen, we have to have you respond to this. Is Trump lazy? Today's Tribune op-ed by Steve Chapman says Trump's laziness will prevent him from implementing his agenda. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know personally, but I think he's I think he is lazy. I think in Steve's op-ed he talks about how Trump gets carted around on a golf cart all the time, so like he's physically lazy, but we all know he's intellectually lazy. The things that he gets things that he gets away with saying, even who was interviewing him recently where he was talking about the job and he was just lamenting how it's so much hard work. It's just so much harder than he thought it was going to be. And he really loved his previous life. I mean, he likes what he's doing now, but he loved his previous life. So, yes, I think he's lazy in both aspects.
Dick Longworth?
Yeah. He is lazy, and he's intellectually lazy, and I think he is personally lazy. There's a good story in the Times this morning from Peter Baker on Trump talking about peace in the Middle East. He was talking with Abbas yesterday, and Trump says, quote, "It's something, this is peace in the Middle East, the end to the Palestinian-Israeli crisis." You may have heard of that one. Trump says, quote, "It's something that I think is frankly maybe not as difficult as people have thought over the years. We will get this done." He even suggested that with his leadership, hopefully there won't be such hatred for very long. This is intellectual laziness. This is incuriosity. This is ignorance. This is a simple refusal to sit down and do the hard work on the issues. And with that sort of approach, you don't get anything done.
Okay. This is from Liz Torres. Liz, where are you? Liz is with the Hill and Knowlton Strategies. Has President Trump been reined in somewhat in the last 100 days? Who do you think is most successful at reining him in? Anybody want to? I see John looking, leaning forward.
I don't see that he's been reined in very much, and I don't know that there's anyone who will be successful at reining him in. I mean, he's a 70-year-old man. He's set in his habits. I think you've got what you've got. So I'm sure people around him, Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, I'm sure they're trying to rein him in. But, I mean, he's a CEO. He is the nation's CEO now, and those guys don't tend to be reined in a whole lot, so I would say no.
Okay. Anyone else want to talk to
that? I mean, I just wonder if there's a sense of reining him in when it comes to who he allows in his inner circle. I think he got burned a little bit with the Michael Flynns, maybe the Steve Bannons. And so maybe as a CEO, he just inherently trusted everyone around him. And maybe in a way, he is slowly learning that politics is just a very different animal. And for him to even have said at one point, you know, he thought Assad was a good guy, and then he finally came around to realize that he's not. I do hope that there is some learning curve with him in who he allows himself to be surrounded with.
Okay. By the way, do you think Sean Spicer will survive? And where has Kellyanne Conway been the last week or so?
I mean, she's another example where I think she got a little too out front on issues and a little too self-promotional, and so I think maybe he tried to rein her in. She's only recently sort of been poking her head back out. Sean Spicer, I think he'll be around as long as he can, like, physically do it. I mean, that is a grueling, grueling job. I think most White Houses churn through spokespeople, what, every year and a half. So I think he's doing the best he can, but that is a really demanding role.
What do you think,
John? I was on a treadmill with Sean Spicer the morning of the election, or the morning before the election, in Manhattan. And he, to me, seemed like he was pretty much planning on going back to Washington. So when people talk about Trump not expecting to win, I really don't think they expected to win, because Spicer sure seemed like he was going back to Washington to get some rest. It didn't work out that way.
Well, speaking of not expecting him to win, this is a question from City Club member Tom Donovan. Could you comment on whether media bias and the resulting backlash helped Trump win the presidency?
What kind of media bias, Tom? This is your question? Like media bias against him or for him? Or?
No, there was no media bias. And every time Donald Trump spoke to the audience, he spoke to the cameras in the back of the room, and the crowds went wild. So he used that bias against him to rally his people.
Oh.
And do you believe that it had an impact on the presidency rally? That, and also, what's happening today? What's the fallout on the media after the Trump election?
I think, you know, the it's not a secret that I don't know what John's polls will show, but people don't like the media very much, and they don't trust it. And I think that he talking about that and speaking openly and loudly about that, it spoke to people. I think it obviously there's something to that. And I think, you know, all the talk about fake news and real news and the debate over what's fake news and what's real news and sort of merging all of these thoughts together so that people are looking at the media maybe as the enemy. I think we all have to examine that. And I think obviously it had an impact on, it certainly was one of the areas that people who voted for him, it resonated with them. I'm not sure that he manipulated that. I think that they already felt a distrust of the media. I think that haven't polls shown that?
Yeah.
Don't we know that by now? I mean, we might be down there with the president. Right?
Used car salesmen.
Right, used car salesmen, lawyers.
Yeah,
everybody. So I think that speaking to that maybe was, I guess my point is that I think he was speaking to something that people already felt. And I think he probably did that in lots of ways. It wasn't just about the media. He was speaking to the feeling that Washington is you know, full of corruption, the feeling that the fix is in, that the little guy can't win. He spoke to a lot of feelings that people really have and that are legitimate. Whether he solves them or not, that's another question. But I think that I don't think it was unfair for him to speak of that. The reason why that resonated with people is because they already felt that way. They were distrustful of the media, and there are some good reasons for that. And we have to work on helping people understand what we're doing, when we report things, where did we get it from, and there are real documents, be very transparent, be much more transparent than we have been.
That's all true, but I hope the media doesn't feel it's in a popularity contest. That's not what the media is about. You know, as long as Trump keeps talking about the failing New York Times, I think you're succeeding probably. The media generally, and I mean, this is so much the change in the nature of the media and the failure of the business model, the decline of reporting staffs, certainly the depletion of newspapers and other media outside the major cities, has put a greater burden on major newspapers like the Times or the Tribune and things like that, generally, which I think are doing a fairly good job on reporting the issues. There is sort of a vast wasteland out there, to steal Newt Minow's phrase, out in the hinterlands, where the press has pretty much disappeared. The newspapers are declining, with some notable exceptions. People get most of their news not from the traditional media, but from social media, or at best, which is pretty worse, Fox News. Talk about bias.
Okay. Charlie Garner with Roosevelt University. He wanted to know if there's any chance that moderates from both parties could get together in Congress and fix health care, pass real tax reform, and address immigration issues.
It feels like there are no moderates, and the moderates get thrown under the bus. I think the only path forward to getting changes are kind of maybe doing what Republicans are trying to do today, which is really strong-arm members. I mean, the moderate Democrat doesn't really necessarily exist anymore. If you look at who they just elected as their Democratic National Committee chairman, and some of their policy and political agenda, and who they elect for their leadership, and then you've got the same situation on the right. So the idea of cooperation and moderation is considered now to be sort of poisonous, which is, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense, but when you had the last significant effort for that, like on immigration reform, and you had the Gang of Eight proposal, it got shot down within, what, hours, days from the Republican Party. Supposedly that was the last movement toward that. And you had people like Marco Rubio have to defend the fact that he tried to find a moderate approach forward. So I don't see that as being possible. But
okay, this is from Carlos Ponce, City Club member. How many Supreme Court appointments do you think President Trump will have in his first term in office? Any guesses?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty hard one. If we had the medical records of all the existing members, maybe.
So there's no rumor that any of the long-serving and chronologically mature judges are considering retiring.
Well, there's always rumors about that, but I think for us to take a stab at that would be pretty risky. I mean, maybe he gets one or two more. I think, again, it depends on whether he gets a second term or not. So hard. That's a tough one.
Okay. Just a couple of questions here. One is, Trump is the first president who has not spent one day in the government or the military. Same true for many of his advisors. What do you think that implies for policy and direction?
Well, from what it's nice to know the territory before you go into it. He has no experience in government or the military or anything outside of the New York real estate business, really, and his real estate business. So he is he has had no opportunity to learn how a government works, how foreign policy and how domestic policy works. Now, a person with a normal intellectual curiosity would be trying to learn this, because it's a steep learning curve for any president, and as we've noted, he does not have that curiosity.
I think it speaks to why, I think John mentioned this earlier, it explains some of the stumbles early on with the administration and process, and it makes, you know, the base of Donald Trump has been very disappointed in Speaker Ryan for even suggesting some sort of a replacement. They just wanted full repeal. But because of Trump's lack of government experience, he needs Paul Ryan more than Paul Ryan needs him. So I think it to the base who wants Trump to succeed, he needs Paul Ryan to succeed too.
Good. This is from Ashvin Ladd, City Club member over here. Has the institution of the American presidency been damaged for the long term by the first 100 days?
I just think it's, you know, I'm not against the 100-day assessment. I think you have to pick a number and make assessments, but I think it's way, way, way too early to know that. Just we don't know. I think there are people who woke up after Election Day and thought that we wouldn't make it through the first 10 days or something, and obviously we're here. But I think using that as a real decision about whether the presidency is damaged is just too early. I think we have to wait.
John and Dick and Kristen, anybody want to chime in on that?
I don't know that it's been damaged, but I think the tweeting to me is just something that I have a hard time getting my mind around. And the fact that we had, I hate to even mention it, but something like the dossier that circulated on Donald Trump, and the fact that that is somehow becomes part of our national discourse with our president is pretty disturbing.
Can I?
Sure, absolutely.
The tweeting, what is it that bothers people about the tweet? What is it that bothers you about him tweeting?
I think it's very casual, and he does it in a very casual way. And I think words matter, and when you have the president sort of carelessly and without anyone over his shoulder making sure what he's, you know, watching what he's saying, it doesn't make me nervous when he's talking about Ivanka and her clothing line and you buy her stuff at Nordstrom or whatever. But when he starts tweeting about North Korea, that makes me nervous.
Okay, I think
As I said, this tweeting really upsets the rest of the world and calls into question American leadership and the degree to which other countries can count on us. Now, if we survive all this, it'll take some time to repair, but we can do this during the early days of the Bush administration when they were going into Iraq against the desire, the wisdom of our various allies. There was a lot of damage done to American-European relations. It took some repairing, but we did get the job done. We survive on this. The whole system is set up to deal with not very smart, not very good sort of mediocre leaders. We can handle. A leader who is off the reservation, who is doing these mad tweets in the middle of the night, that's something a little bit beyond what the designers had in mind.
Okay, and the very last question, it's a very broad question, so just a lightning round, as they say, kind of answer. This is from Jasmine Hanser. Jasmine, where are you? She's way over there on the left. She's affiliated with the Republican National Hispanic Assembly. And her question deals with freedom of religion and faith, an action taken today by the president and vice president, and that the president is going to meet with Muslim leaders in Saudi Arabia. This question of religion and faith and how the administration is approaching it. Any comments?
How is the administration approaching it?
I'm not sure.
So to compare how President Obama and Vice President Biden, how their 100 days compare with the 100 days of President Trump and Vice President?
Oh, that would have been a very simple question. Okay, thank you. I think you somewhat addressed this, but a quick response to it. How does the Trump-Pence 100 days compare to the Obama-Biden 100 days?
From a religious standpoint.
That was her question.
Yeah. I'll take a stab at it. I think for Trump and Pence appealing to the conservative base is very important. So some of the actions that they've taken, Supreme Court, this action today, are going to be hugely popular with the Republican base and the evangelical right. During the campaign, we always sort of thought it odd how well Trump, a thrice married man with, you know, some things that came up during the campaign, videos and whatnot, that he was doing as well as he was with the evangelical base. But He has held their support and seems to continue to do so, and these recent actions will only help from that regard, I think.
Anybody else want to comment on that matter? Okay, thank you. Thank you, John, for responding to Jasmine's question. Let's give them a big round of applause.